Sarah from The Journey and welcome to The Weekly. Now, I don't know about you, but I never seem to have quite enough hours in the day to fit everything in, and I certainly don't seem to have enough hours in the day to read all the interesting things that are out there. We thought we probably weren't alone in this, so we created The Weekly, which is a condensed version of all the key things we've been looking at over the last week or so in an easy, digestible podcast form that you can listen to on the go. Now, you might be wondering, if you're new to us, what even is The Journey? Well, we are dedicated to bringing you the latest science and evidence-based research around everything to do with conception, pregnancy, and the early years of a little person's life. The reality is, the world looks very different from the one that existed even just 10, 15 years ago, but in many cases, the advice we're given hasn't changed. There's a lot of fake news out there as well, so we're dedicated to bringing you practical things you can do, most crucially, all backed by science. So, without further ado, what is on offer this week? Okay, so we've got a few things on today. First up is for the boys. It seems like our swimmers, shall we put it, are under fire more than ever. In fact, research has shown that sperm count on average is down over 50% over the last 40 years. Of course, there are many, many factors behind this, but we look at whether or not vitamin D, and certainly a deficiency of that, could be connected. We look at what you need to know and what you can potentially do to rectify it. Next up is all about group B streptococcus. Now, this is something you need to know about if you are thinking about being pregnant, you are pregnant, and certainly if you're about to give birth. Now, a lot of countries out there thankfully screen for this as routine. Unfortunately, the UK and a couple of others do not. So, as always, we think it's about awareness and taking matters into your own hands where you can. So, we're going to be running through exactly what this is and what you should be thinking about if you are a parent to be. Next up, we are going to be looking at the fertility decline and specifically what you can potentially do about it. And this is for boys and girls. Now, inevitably, as we age, our fertility declines. It does seem to be one of those very, very sensitive things. And we're always on the lookout for what the latest science is suggesting could be a way to make that decline slightly less steep. And we're going to be looking at the latest science around this when it comes to intermittent fasting, which is obviously a diet that is on many people's radars at the moment. And then finally, we're going to be thinking about birth. Now, birth is probably one of the most unpredictable things out there. Now, we're again all about being prepared for every eventuality and doing everything we can to make sure that no matter what cards you're dealt, you can do it in the healthiest possible way. So we're going to be looking at one technique around C-sections, which is something called vaginal seeding. We're going to be looking at what this allegedly does and what the science is and what the pros and cons are, in order for you to be able to make a decision to see whether or not this could be something right for you or worth considering. So without further ado, let's kick it off. Okay, so vitamin D. Boys, what do you need to know? Now, vitamin D deficiency is pretty much blamed for most things these days. Question is, what does the science actually say about its role in male fertility? And more specifically, around the growing sperm crisis. Now, what crisis is this? Well, the fact that sperm counts on average have fallen over 50% in the last 40 years. Yep, true story. So what we wanted to do is to look at some of the many, many factors that may well be behind this, because as usual, there's not one definitive silver bullet. So let's take a look at what the research is saying about vitamin D. Now, we know there are two interesting things when it comes to vitamin D. One, many of us, particularly in the Northern Hemisphere, are actually deficient. And some data in the US, for example, shows deficiency in as many as 40% of the population. Now, of course, this is an average, so there's wide variations around that, but that just gives you a bit of an idea. Secondly, over the last decade or so, we're starting to realise that vitamin D has a much greater role to play in keeping the body in optimal function, much more than we previously thought. A lot of the historical thinking around vitamin D is that it's good for your bones and things like that, but actually what we're learning is that it plays a role in almost everything from hormone production and regulation to even the immune system. We've got a lot more on that on the site. Now, research has even demonstrated links between adequate vitamin D levels in pregnancy and development of autoimmunity or infection risk in children. So again, check out thejourneydot.com for more on that. Okay, so what about for men and their fertility? So as we said, there has been a pretty major decline over the last few decades. And as always, there's rarely a single reason. But we look at whether or not vitamin D deficiency, seeing as so many people have it, could be one of the reasons. Now, we have known for a while that vitamin D is important in some way for male reproduction. How do we know this? Well, we know that vitamin D receptors and metabolizing enzymes are present in the testes and other areas. So, for example, the reproductive cell within semen. And that has actually led scientists to do a bit more digging. Question is, how and how much does this actually matter when it comes to effectively trying to have a healthy baby? Now, the reality is that despite quite a bit of investigation, and this includes both animal and human studies, the data is still pretty murky with quite a bit of contradiction. If only it were that simple. However, here is what we do know. Now, although there is less conclusive evidence around its role in testosterone production, for example, some studies have shown a beneficial effect of vitamin D on male fertility more broadly, and this appears to have the most compelling data around semen quality. In fact, the most consistent supporting evidence lies around sperm motility, specifically within the whole segment when you're looking at quality, which is obviously a pretty important part of the picture. We also know that it might play quite a crucial role in terms of production. There is some evidence, in fact, to suggest that having enough vitamin D may in fact be protective against something that we know is at the heart of many issues when it comes to sperm, and that is DNA damage or fragmentation. Now, we write a ton about this on the site, and in fact, it was interesting because on one of the recent podcasts we did with a leading miscarriage specialist, Dr. Shiata, and again, check out the podcast from him, he talked about DNA damage or sperm or fragmentation, I should say, within sperm as something he looks at very closely when he's looking at recurrent miscarriage. Now, this typically results from something called oxidative stress, which again is something we talk about a lot about on the site in a nutshell. This is where you get damage to cells, and it looks as though sperm cells are particularly vulnerable to this. Now, question is, how does vitamin D provide protection for this type of damage? Now, once again, some of the studies have shown vitamin D plays a role in producing a particular molecule that actually prevents oxidative stress. Now, it does look as though, in fact, that this fragmentation or this damage from cells increases significantly in the cells of animals with vitamin D deficient diet. So once again, it does look as though this is playing a part. Now, the other key areas like regulation of hormones like testosterone have been examined, but as of now, the results really are not totally conclusive. Okay, so that's where we are in terms of research. Question is, what do you actually do about it? As with most things, keeping a healthy and balanced body is always, always the way to go, particularly when it comes to trying to have a healthy child. Now, vitamin D does play a significant role in many of our body's functionality, and it does seem that healthy sperm is another area. We firmly believe always that getting your own individual picture is the best way to go. Nobody looks the same. And a simple blood test that you can ask your doctor to do will tell you very quickly what your own internal picture looks like. We are always wary about supplement use when it's not necessary. And we are also all about knowledge being power. So it's something that you can approach your doctor about and hopefully get a simple blood test. Now, if you are deficient, how do you get enough? Or how do you get more? Now, of course, the most effective way to get enough vitamin D is via the sun. Half an hour of sunlight delivers something as much as 50,000 international units of vitamin D, and that's for people with Caucasian skin, because actually it's worth bearing in mind that skin pigmentation lowers the amount of vitamin D synthesis that you get from UV exposure. So what we mean by that is the darker your skin, the less you are likely to get, so you have to also bear that in mind. Now, the other thing is, what does 50,000 international units mean in real life? Often we hear these huge numbers and it's very difficult to understand what that means in context, and it can be confusing. But to give you an idea, 10 micrograms is the amount recommended by the NIC guidelines for pregnant and breastfeeding mothers, and that's equivalent to about 400 international units. So as you can see, 50,000 that we get from half an hour in the sun is a lot. Now, the main risk factors for having a low level are obviously if you live in areas with less sunlight, or you spend a lot of time indoors if you're on a desk job, for example. Obviously as well during the winter months when the days are shorter. And then of course, if you always cover your skin or you always use a high factor sunblock that many of us now do. And then of course, the darker your skin, the more you might need to have greater amounts of vitamin D. Other things are BMI. So if you're obese and that's a BMI over 30, that can be a risk factor. And again, if you're vegan, because eggs, oily fish are rich in vitamin D. The other thing is our old friend genetics. Some people do have genetic abnormalities which can impact how vitamin D is metabolized and transported around the body, which is another reason that it's always good to go and get your own level checked. So again, coming back to the question of how do we get more? Sun exposure can be a tricky thing. Obviously, you may not practically be able to get it. And we're also aware of the dangers of too much sun. If only it was easy. Now, the good news is that you don't need to sunbathe. Typically, just 15 minutes a day in the sun, 2 or 3 times a week, should be good enough in sunny weather. And you only need to expose your arms and face. Of course, being sun safe is another key thing. So you need to avoid the peak sun hours. And then, of course, again, everyone is different, so it does depend on your skin type, the type of time of day and time of year. So once again, if you're in doubt, it's very simple. Just get your levels tested. And what about supplements? So if you're not keen on the sun route, what should you take? Now, once again, we're really, really passionate that when it comes to supplements, they can be very useful, but you have to be careful. So speaking to your doctor, checking your levels is always good before supplementing with anything. Now, similarly, you do want to get enough, and if sun exposure isn't for you and you want to take a supplement, D3 with a fat to help absorption, and again, we've got a lot more on the site about how you better absorb some of the good stuff into your body, is definitely the way to go. So if you want any more info on this, check out thejourney.com and have fun in the sun if you can. Okay, so next up, it is once again about one of our favorite topics, the gut microbiome. But this time, instead of looking at how the gut microbiome is so important for health, we are actually going to be flagging a bug that is present in some of us that can actually pose a pretty major risk to your new baby, and that is Group B Streptococcus, also known as GBS. So obviously, we are rapidly learning that many of the billions of bacteria in our gut play a very important role for our health. We also know that it impacts the health of our babies and future babies, and there's so much on the site about that. But once again, not all of this bacteria that's present is good. Now, Group B Streptococcus can in fact pose quite a significant risk to new babies, and it, we believe, is something that every parent-to-be should know about. So what we're going to do is we're going to go through what it is, how it can impact a very young baby, and most importantly, as always, the practical side, what you can do to prevent a very serious infection. So taking a step back, what is this and why should we care about it? So research suggests that between around 12 and 35% of the population globally have colonization of Group B Streptococcus. And that's within the gut and within the genital tract. So in the US, for example, the CDC estimates it to be carried by around 25% of pregnant women. So it's not entirely uncommon. So what's the problem? So the reality is that it can be an entirely normal part of the human microflora. It can be persistent, i.e. always there, or it can come and go over time. But typically as an adult, if you've got a decent immune system, you will have absolutely no symptoms or problems at all. In fact, the majority of people won't even know that it's there. The trouble comes, however, with new babies, because unfortunately its presence can potentially cause life-threatening infections. And this is obviously where we've got much more of an issue. Now, before you panic, don't. Here's what you need to know. So new babies, especially ones that are premature, obviously do not have very well-developed immune systems. In fact, research suggests that they're generally deficient in the antibodies specific to group B streptococcus in particular, which is why this bug can be such a problem. Now, unfortunately, if you do get exposure to this bug early on, it can lead to anything from premature birth to stillbirth to meningitis to pneumonia. In fact, GBS is the number one cause of sepsis and meningitis in new babies. And unfortunately, it's also the leading cause of infant death, particularly in the first week of life. Now, once again, I know that sounds scary, but don't panic, because this is where knowledge is a great thing. And the good news is there's so much and very easy things you can do to prevent any kind of these nasties from occurring. So let's set the scene how we do this. So when it comes to group B early onset, which is when the baby gets an infection in the first 6 days passed from the mother, we know that it's the mother that needs to have this within the gastro or the genital tract in order to pass it on. So what do you do? Well, the very first step is to check that. And the good news on this is it's very easy to do. Now, we know that the transmission comes during or just prior to birth. In fact, colonization of the mother is the most important risk factor for this type of infection to happen. So basically, we know roughly when the infection, if it's going to occur, will happen, and that's during birth. Now, what's slightly less clear is when it comes to the role of this bug in preterm birth, because the research is suggesting that it can potentially play a role, but it's not fully understood at this point. But once again, a simple swab test can tell you if you have this particular bug in your system. And after that, if you do test positive, then a dose of antibiotics during labour can protect your baby, which is obviously great news. Now, next question is, what about the test? Will you get it? And how does the test work? Once again, because this is such a powerful thing, so many countries now offer this test as standard to pregnant women, which is great news, including the US. So the first thing is always worth checking with your healthcare provider if you get offered a test as standard. Now, unfortunately, under the NHS in the UK, they do not offer this test as standard. Understandably, resource is an issue. And one of the reasons that they may not offer it is the fact that if a baby gets a bacteria, it does not always mean that they will get a serious infection. All it does is increase the risk. Some countries like the UK prefer what is known as a risk-based approach, i.e. you'll only be screened if you have other risk factors. So for example, it can be a previous case of GBS infection or a premature birth, for example. But around 50% of the babies who are born to women who do test positive for GBS will become colonized themselves. Now, the good news is not all babies will pick it up and not all babies will actually get a serious infection, but it is possible that that there are some babies that will. Now, unfortunately, according to data published in the UK, who, as I said, do not offer standardized screening, around 43 babies a month are currently infected by an infection caused by GBS. So although the NHS may tell you that it's very rare, it's not actually that rare. And it's absolutely something as a parent to be that I would want to be aware of, and I'm sure you want to be aware of as well, and is something at least worth having a conversation with your doctor or healthcare provider about. Now, on the test itself, there's some pretty compelling data. So the US is an interesting example of progress when it comes to dealing with GBS. So over the years, the policies have changed a lot, and research has come out that have actually meant that the US has strengthened their policy. And this is once again after new data found that universal screening for group B was more than 50% more effective at preventing any infection compared to this risk-based approach. So this is one of the reasons that the US and other countries now offer the test as standard to everyone. Now, the current recommendation in the US and other countries is a swab between 35 and 37 weeks of pregnancy. So as you can see, it's really pretty simple. And in fact, so simple to do that some instances you can even do it yourself at home with a self-test kit. And in fact, there has been research showing that this is pretty much as good if you do it yourself as if a doctor or nurse does it for you. So the next question is, what happens if you do test positive for this colonization? Because obviously I know myself, if I tested positive and I had heard all this, I'd be panicking. But once again, there's some good news here. As always, we think if you know what you're dealing with, it's very easy to prevent a problem developing. And this case is no exception. Now, if you test positive, the first port of call is obviously a discussion with your doctor. And one study showed that 100% of the women who had antibiotic treatment prevented colonization in their babies. And against this, nearly 60% of women who did not have treatment did pass it on. Now, the good news, once again, is that the results are very good. And this strategy of giving antibiotics during labor if you test positive has significantly reduced the incident of this early onset infection in those countries who have the screening policy. And in fact, the results are really startlingly positive. We've got the stats out there, but effectively, incidence in the US dropped from 2 babies out of every 1,000 being born down to just 0.2 in every 1,000 being affected. So that's really pretty good going. So once again, the way that it's dealt with is if you have a positive test, your doctor will administer antibiotics during labour, and that will be over a 4-hour period. And in fact, it's worth noting that it's suggested by research that it's effective during labour rather than being administered before. Now, the downside, because as we know, nothing is perfect, the most obvious downside is with administration of antibiotics. And antibiotic resistance is a real risk anytime you give any form of antibiotic. And the other issue, of course, is that not only will it stop transmission of GBS, but it will also potentially interfere with the transfer of good bacteria from the mother to the child. However, as we said, when used correctly, antibiotics can, of course, be life-saving. And this is certainly the case with potential GBS infections in very young babies. And as it stands, it's the only way at this moment to effectively prevent it. There are being other things being trialled, like a vaccine, but at the moment, this is still the way to go. Now, the second issue that can come up is that because this colonization can come and go in people, you can get a negative reading, say when you get tested at 35 weeks and then be colonized by the time of birth. So this is not an entirely fail-safe method. And that's, you know, with most things, and it's just always something worth to bear in mind, although it is pretty rare. With one center who offered this screening reporting only 14 cases of a false negative over nearly a 10-year period. So it's rare, but it's always something worth bearing in mind. So the bottom line, as always, we are firm believers in prevention and knowledge of your own individual circumstance being your best friend. The test itself is very simple to do and will give you an indication if you are more at risk or not. And even better, in some countries, it's offered as standard. So make sure you get yours done and always check in with your healthcare provider about it. Now, once again, if you do test positive, then you and your doctor may decide that antibiotics during labour is the best form of action. We fully believe that forewarned is at least forearmed. So just check it out with your healthcare provider. And don't worry, if you do test positive, there's lots of positive things you can do about it. So for more on that, check out thejourneydot.com. Next up, is this a diet that can help prevent the inevitable decline in fertility? Now, I don't know about you, but there always seems to be a new trendy diet on the go at any moment in time, and I've certainly heard my fair share about intermittent fasting. But we look at the question is, does this method of eating actually boost your hormones, and does it halt or at least halt the rapid decline in fertility as we age? So we take a look at what this diet is and what the science seems to be suggesting. So taking a step back, here's what we know. So you've probably heard a lot of the hype around intermittent fasting. What is this? It's essentially alternating between eating and fasting, and there's various different ways you can do it. So there's the 5-2, which is basically 2 days of very, very low calorie intake, and then 5 days of eating normally. Or there's another way, the 16-8 is becoming popular, and that means that within a 24-hour period, you're allowed to eat 8 hours of that and fast for 16. And it seems as though people are talking about doing this diet not only for weight loss, but for a variety of health-based reasons. Now, from our perspective, what's caught our eye is that the science suggests this could, stress on the could, be a significant potential benefit when it comes to our ability to have healthy kids, and specifically the benefits that are being shown around hormonal balance, oxidative stress, which, as we've talked about many times before, is about cell damage, and even potentially temporarily halting our decline in fertility. So as always, there is no single bullet solution or answer. It's always about lots of little things together. But what the science does suggest is that there are some real results starting to come through. Now, here's what the science is suggesting. First up, for your hormones, it's increasingly being recognized that intermittent fasting can have a benefit for your hormones, particularly when it comes to something that's been impacting a lot of us, which is insulin resistance. Essentially, intermittent fasting, it looks as though, can improve this. Now, why does insulin resistance matter, and what is it? So insulin resistance is when your body does not react as it should to insulin. Now, insulin, if you think about it this way, is a little bit like a key that should unlock the door for sugar to go from your blood after you've eaten a meal into a cell and used for energy. Now, when your cells don't react properly to this, it can cause a number of issues, including more insulin to be produced because effectively the sugar is not getting into the cell, so you need more keys to try and unlock it, which can also lead to higher blood sugar, can lead to things like fatigue, weight gain, amongst other things. Now, from a fertility perspective, it's also really important. Now, insulin resistance is very common amongst people who have polycystic ovaries. And in fact, around 70% of sufferers have some form of insulin resistance. Now, crucially, the more insulin you produce, the more it can impact the ovaries, causing an imbalance. And in fact, it affects testosterone and something called SHBG, which is basically what transports testosterone to where it really needs to be. And when you have too much of this free testosterone, it's not being transported properly, you have that washing around your body, you can get a lot of the symptoms that are common to PCOS. Now, the bottom line is these types of imbalances do not make conception and pregnancy any easier, and it applies to men as well. In fact, the data shows that men with diabetes and pre-diabetes have less levels of testosterone, for example, which is obviously key for production of sperm. But it's also related to weight gain, and higher BMI, of course, are associated with all kinds of other complications. So the question is, what can you do about it? Now, intermittent fasting does look like another tool in the fight against this. Now, we look at many on the site. So for example, certain types of exercise, certain types of supplement, inositol, for example, but the research suggests, although it's still in its relatively infancy, is that there is potential benefit from eating this way and improving insulin resistance. And in fact, it doesn't just appear to happen because you lose weight. Interestingly enough, insulin resistance can impact people who have something called lean PCOS, so people without a raised BMI. So that's one thing to bear in mind, and that's good for both men and women, and in fact, everybody. Next question is, can it help stop the inevitable fertility decline or decline in egg quality? Now, some of the most interesting work, albeit once again not fully understood yet, is around what intermittent fasting appears to do when it comes to fertility, and specifically preservation of fertility as we age. Now, this is really quite interesting because many of us, me included, are getting older before we feel ready to have children. Once again, turning to the science. Now, most of the work is still in animal studies and is not yet fully understood, but the bottom line is there's been demonstration in results that periods of fasting, which effectively temporarily shut down reproductive function, could prolong fertility, could improve egg quality, and even halt some of the decline that comes with age. This sounds pretty out there, but here's how it seems to work. Now, it appears to relate to a cell's powerhouse, which is called the mitochondria. Now, as we get older, the number of these within the cell and the activity levels starts to fall, which is in part why we have less good quality eggs as we get older. Now, whether it's from evolution in order to preserve fertility during times of famine, we're not sure. But what seems to happen is that the number and the activity level of mitochondria in the cells are actually boosted when we fast. So it's pretty cool stuff. Now, one study in mice suggested intermittent fasting might temporarily shut down active fertility and, in fact, might free up energy that could be used to enhance maintenance. So, again, preserving viability and fertility for when the period of famine has passed. Now, what's also interesting is that other ways to quote unquote preserve fertility, like CoQ10, for example, also seem to work on these important powerhouses, the mitochondria. So it does seem like there's something to be said for this. Now, this type of research is obviously pretty important because many of us don't feel ready or able to have children until our 30s and beyond. Now, certainly in some studies, it appears that not only can this potentially help when it keeps us to keeping fertile for longer, but it could also help with egg quality. So that could be another angle that is actually super helpful. Now, what about for the boys? Now, intermittent fasting has shown some benefit against something that tends to be behind cell damage, and we mentioned earlier in the podcast, and that's oxidative stress. And this is one of the things that damages sperm the most. So next question, can intermittent fasting help reduce oxidative stress? Now, whilst we don't know too much about it at this stage around sperm specifically, what we do know is that intermittent fasting has been shown some benefits reducing oxidative stress more broadly and interestingly showing a protective factor specifically for lipids, which is what sperm is made up of. So question is it worth giving it a go? Now, once again, the science is not totally conclusive at this stage, but there are some positive indicators to at least consider. Now, once again, different things work for different people, and this is absolutely not advised if you're pregnant or breastfeeding. And if in doubt, you always should speak to your doctor. And always before making any dietary changes, you should consult with your doctor. It's just a simple and smart thing to do. Now, how do you do it? Well, there's some interesting ways on that on the site. So check out thejourneydoc.com about how some of the latest techniques around that actually work and working out what could be good for you. So check it out. Okay, finally, it's all about vaginal seeding. Now, what is this? Why on earth would you need to know about it? And what is the controversy? Because there definitely is controversy around this. So what we're going to do is we're going to take a look at the latest science, some of the concerns, all in order to help you make a decision that's right for you and your family, because after all, everyone's an individual. So taking a step back, research is increasingly pointing once again to the fact that the gut microbiome, which is the collection of bacteria, fungi, viruses in the gut, can have potential long-term health consequences. Now, we also know that the foundation, which gets built from pregnancy and starts to stabilize really in a child between 2 and 3 years old, is key. Now, at this relatively early stage, science is broadly suggesting that we want a diverse mix of this bacteria and no imbalances. And one of the first key events in developing a new microbiome is birth. Now, we know that birth is one of the most unpredictable things, but research does suggest that a natural birth, i.e. via the birth canal, is better for that all-important diversity and balance of the microbiome. However, we also know that sometimes this is just not possible. I, for example, had a cesarean. Now, the big question is there an alternative to help the microbiome along, even if your baby doesn't pass through the birth canal? And some of the early research is suggesting that there could be an alternative, and that is vaginal seeding. So let's take a step back. As we said, there are two things we know for sure when it comes to birth. Number one is unpredictable. Number two, how it happens can potentially play a part in the future health implications for a baby. Now, once again, with all the will in the world, birth is something we are never going to have full control over. It's great to have a plan, but the chances of curveballs being thrown along the way are very real. I always remember a conversation I had with my obstetrician. I said, so let me get this straight. There is no rhyme or reason why one person has an easy, normal, natural birth and another person doesn't. And he said, correct. Now, that being said, we have learned that there are differences in the gut microbiota of a baby born via vaginal natural routes versus one that's born via a C-section. And something, these differences, of course, have been linked in part to development of potential health complications further down the road. So here's some potentially good news if, like me, a C-section is on the cards. Now, many people, and this, as I said, is me included, ended up having a C-section birth. For me, the actual process, luckily, was really quite straightforward, but there can be some emotional sensitivities around it, and it's something that I really personally suffered from. Now, the worst thing to do, which is what, of course, I did to myself when I learned about the implications for the gut and future immune health, is to beat yourself up about it. Because the reality is, as with most things in life, there are so many different factors at play, so it doesn't automatically mean anything bad, and that's really important to remember if you do have a C-section. And the other good news is that there are lots of other potential things you can do to help this process along after the baby is born. Now, of course, a C-section birth is often life-saving, and if a decision has been made to do it, then that means you and your baby's best interests are for doing that. So that's a major positive and should never be discounted. I personally wasted a lot of time and energy being upset about mine, and that is exactly that. It's a waste of time and energy. Now, here's what you can potentially do, though, if you do want to try to counteract some of that. And this is where it gets a bit controversial. So the main difference in the gut microbiome of a C-section baby versus one born naturally is that this C-section baby misses out the bacteria that are present in the birth canal. So the question is, what if you can still provide that to a C-section baby? Now, when I first heard that people were transferring microbes from the birth canal to a C-section newborn's face and mouth, I was quite shocked. But the research that has been done on this does show that this is not potentially entirely as crazy as it sounds. Now, when you look at a couple of papers on this, it does show that actually restoration of this microbiota development in infants born via cesarean can potentially be achieved by this route. Now, recent results suggest that the skin, the oral microbiota, and the rest of exposed babies do more closely resemble those of vaginally born babies who have undergone the process of vaginal seeding. Now, the long-term health consequences of doing this remain unclear because it's still relatively new research, but the results do show that vaginal microbes can be at least partially restored at birth and cesarean section delivery in these babies. Now, how is this actually done is the other big question. Now, a typical method for vaginal seeding is the following. So you take a sterile gauze in the vagina of mothers that were negative for group B streptococcus, which is obviously just something that we talked about, and had other criteria. And that is during the hour before the C-section. Now, the next thing is, within the first 2 minutes of birth, babies were then exposed to this swab with the gauze, starting with the mouth and then the face and finally the rest of the body. And this is effectively to try and simulate the exact same mechanism of how they'd be exposed if they passed through the birth canal naturally. Now, the issue here is that the sample sizes of a lot of the research is pretty limited. And actually, a lot of the research extends only through the impact of the first couple of months after birth. But what is being shown by some research papers, once again, is that it can be partially restored to resemble that of vaginally delivered babies. Now, once again, the caveat here is the research on vaginal seeding is pretty new and it's underdeveloped and it is most definitely not complete. And if you speak to many doctors, they will either have never heard of this or they will push back that the research is still extremely new. And that's absolutely fair. However, if nothing else, it's food for thought, and it's certainly something that's worth at the very least opening a discussion with your doctors. Some are more for it than others. That being said, it is of course not something for everyone. Not everyone is comfortable with it, and this is simply information. What you choose to do with it, as always, is up to you. The other thing, of course, is it's all to do with whether or not you can get screened for group B streptococcus. And that is the most common cause of sepsis in babies. So once again, that is something that you have to be extremely mindful of if you are going to be thinking about doing this. So Bottom line of all of this, clearly more evidence is needed. However, what has been done so far is quite compelling. Now, once again, we think options and awareness remain key. And then after that is personal choice, up to you, and no harm at least having a discussion about it with your doctor. Now, for all of these topics, and obviously much more, check out thejourneydot.com. And if you're enjoying the podcast, please give us a rating and a review. We really appreciate that. And finally, if you do want to pass on any comments or topics you'd like us to discuss, please reach out to us, info@thejourneydot.com. And we'll see you next week.